What is up, podcast community? My name is Michael Chernow, and this is the Creatures of Habit podcast. Habits are everything, and on this show, I will be interviewing some of the most inspiring, motivated, and high-performing humans on the planet to learn about the daily habits, routines, and rituals that help keep them focused, determined, on top of their game, and ultimately, happy. My journey from the depths of addiction and misery to success as a family man and serial entrepreneur was only made possible by replacing bad habits with great ones, and my mission in life today is to share that story and the story of others with you to bring value and life-changing tools to as many people as possible. So sit back, relax, and pay attention, because what you hear in this podcast today can potentially change your life. Let's go. Today I have a guest on that is really exciting for me for a number of reasons. One, I have not had a guest on the podcast that I can communicate with and learn more about the recovery arena. Everybody, you know, that follows me on social media and listens to this podcast pretty much knows that I've been in recovery for 18 years. I got sober when I was 23 years old, and it has been the cornerstone foundation and structure for everything I have put together in my life, including happiness. It is everything. And it's given me this opportunity to live a life beyond my wildest dreams. It's a promise that you're given, early on in sobriety that you kind of roll your eyes about. But Evan Haynes is the co-founder of Oro House Recovery. Oro House was named by a number of different outlets as one of the number one dual diagnosis recovery centers in the United States of America. And as we all know, there are a lot of recovery centers in the US. So having a accolade like that is huge. I'm super excited to be able to talk with Evan. He's also an author of a book that he launched last year called Can America Recover? Reimagining the Drug Problem. We all also know, if we pay any attention to the news, that the overdose rate in the United States and globally, but really bad here in the United States, is at an all-time high. There's never been a time in history that we have seen this many overdoses. We have a real epidemic, and Evan is at the forefront of trying to understand it, communicate, and bring awareness to what we're dealing with. And I'm so pumped to be able to have a conversation with him about habits today. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
I believe habit is what makes or breaks human beings. My habits almost broke me. I was knocking on death's door, and I got very, very lucky. I got a little sliver of grace. I slipped into it and was lucky enough to get sober. And I changed all of my bad habits and replaced them with great ones. And that's what sort of given me an opportunity to dream and fulfill. And so I have made it my mission to bring awareness to positive habits, because when people hear the word habit, in most cases, there's a negative connotation to it. It's rare that you see, people say, I've got this great habit. Most people are like, oh, I got to kick this bad habit. And so I believe that habit is so much more powerful when you think about it in a positive way. Obviously, there's nothing better than living our lives. And when you incorporate habits in a negative way, it is really detracting from that possibility of living. So I would love to ask you about your morning routine, your evening routine, some habits that you do on a regular basis that help keep you on the beam. I know you're also in recovery, so I'm really interested to hearing some of these things. But why don't you give us a little intro from your mouth so that we have a better idea as to who you are.
I mean, obviously, as far as my habits go, drinking was a bad one for me. It didn't do me any good, and it certainly didn't do other people good. I had a habit of drinking a lot to the point of blacking out and driving my car. I could have killed somebody. And I eventually was sent to LA County Jail one night, came to on the curb after running into a car with a person in it. Talk about shaking up a habit. I mean, I was horrified, and that was that little kind of sliver of grace for me. and an opportunity to really shake that habit, you know, shake it up, loosen it up, drop it, pick up some new ones. So quitting drinking, you know, this new sober lifestyle, it's a habit in its own right.
The first question I always ask is if you can take us through in as meticulous a way as possible, what your morning routine looks like from the second you you wake up and from the second you wake up. What do you
think? It's a good question. It's a good question because some of it I'm not totally proud of. The first thing I probably do is reach over for my phone. I'll admit, I'm going to be honest.
good. Honesty is good.
Yeah. I want to clear my inbox, you know, and in that sense, I think it's the right idea. I want to clear my head, see if there's anything, you know, we're running a treatment center. We're dealing with a lot of chaos, obviously, with the nature of our clientele. So the first thing I do is I make sure everything was okay last night and that everybody's safe. That's the most important thing for me. So then sometimes I'll read the news. I make sure, you know, the world hasn't blown up, that it's still there. Once I've established that, I'll kind of start to open my eyes a little bit, walk into the kitchen, make a pot of French press coffee, and proceed to sit down and drink two cups while I kind of read the internet. And then I've been going to the gym in my building for almost exactly a half hour workout, 7-minute warm up, get the blood going, get my respiration going. And then I do like kind of a superset of 4 exercises. And at that point, I mean, I come back and I eat, I'm energized, you know, it's still only maybe 8:30 in the morning, 9 in the morning. And I start my day and I've been working at home a lot. I'm also in school, as you pointed out, getting my doctorate. So, and I have a business partner who's so great running a lot of the day-to-day operations so that I'm able to focus on reading and writing for school. And I'll work from home. And I'll be honest, like that is spotty. I mean, I'll even writing the book, you know, if I was showing up at that point, I was going to the office. No one else was there over COVID. And if I spent 7 hours that day, and that was a habit too, I had a way of doing it. If I got like 4 hours of actual writing out of a day, that was good. I can only hold together whatever my tasks are throughout the day so much. I'll release with some kind of scrolling around on Instagram, or I love reading. I love like just seeing what weird new stuff's happening out in the world, or I'll get inspired, maybe even doing that. And then I'll bring that back to my routine, kind of keeping everything alive that way.
You get done with the gym, you come back, you eat, and then you kind of start your work day. Yeah. And then I would imagine that there is a time that you kind of draw a line and say, okay, I'm going to end my sort of work life and start my personal stuff. Do you have like a wind down routine that you do?
Honestly, I struggle so hard to work that it's sort of easy. I just stop. I just eventually stopped forcing myself to work. I feel like I'm a little bit lazy as a person, yet, you know, I'm a contradiction. I've accomplished a lot. I'm lazy and ambitious. I'm like both. And so it's easy enough for me to just stop doing it. Yet, you know, again, this contradiction, I run my own business. So I'm constantly tormented by, you know, whether it's on the financial end or the human end, dealing with struggling people who are in pain. So I've chosen this life. I'm not complaining, but it's being an entrepreneur, which you know all about. It's all consuming. So no, I don't have the best self-care, and I'm blessed with building a life for myself that is very amenable to my inherent laziness at the same time, if that makes sense. And I also want to make an argument for a little bit of chaos too. I'm someone who kind of holds the tension between habit and chaos. And I believe that those two things actually fit together in a really interesting way that I could talk about if you want.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about your structure / chaotic experience.
I didn't invent this theory, but I heard it and it's always stuck with me. And it's he's sort of a, I guess, philosopher, biologist named Rupert Sheldrake. And he talks about sort of chaos and habit in the universe or in nature. So without habit, there would be no stability. Again, we wouldn't hold the shape of a body for 75 or 80 years if there wasn't stability. The earth wouldn't exist if there wasn't stability. And there would be no creativity without chaos. And if I think about my own story in recovery, had I not crashed my car that night, you know, we might not be having this conversation. If my habit had continued forever without something to disrupt and disturb it, this new life that really was created out of that would never have occurred. All evolution, nature, it's all of these sort of collisions and sort of entropy. All life, of course, comes out of decay. That's how nature works. Mm-hmm. And so there's a pre-Socratic philosopher named Empedocles, and so this is going back, you know, 2,500 years. He argued that there's two forces in the universe, sort of in along similar lines, that there's strife and love. Love brings everything together and holds it together, and strife blows it apart. There's a simplistic reading that, well, of course, love is better, strife is bad, love is good. But what Empedocles was really saying, he was making an argument for chaos, an argument for strife, because what happens in love and in life sometimes, we can become kind of locked into habits, good or bad, I suppose. But he called it the spell. We can kind of find ourselves under the spell of Aphrodite. And what we write about in Can America Recover is that the habits of a whole culture, one that has given rise to this huge addiction and overdose epidemic, that whole culture has habits. We call them customs. These are social customs, cultural customs. You know, of course, cultures are made up of individuals. Every individual has their routine. You know, we do everything kind of very similarly, the same way every day. And there's something about our routines, and I think it has a lot to do with the nature of work personally, and work and play for that matter, that are kind of unhealthy. They're not good habits, but we don't even see them as being habits. We're blind to them. I'll just add this in terms of addiction. There's an amazing neuroscientist named Mark Lewis, and he wrote a book called The Biology of Desire. And he goes toe-to-toe with the National Institute of Drug Addiction and its longtime head, Nora Volkoff, and argues with her where the official sort of definition of addiction, according to NIDA, is that it's a chronic relapsing brain disease, as evidenced by decay of the gray matter in the prefrontal cortex. And what he comes along, Mark Lewis comes along and says, is that addiction is basically a habit, is what he's arguing, but it's the product of deep learning. And that the same way addiction works, that's how we learn to speak, how a musician learns to play an instrument. So the musician learns to play, say, the violin, but when she becomes sort of the master of her instrument, she's not thinking about how to play the violin anymore. Same thing when we learn the English language as children, we learn this language. We don't have to think about it every time we use the language. It becomes really unconscious. And so the loss of gray matter and the synaptic pruning that NIDA sees in the development of habits, basically, is actually perfectly normal. That's how this brain, this super efficient organ, can create the same outcome with less effort. It's habit. Like you say, it's all habit. Some habits are good, some habits are bad, but I would argue that we need to question all of our habits.
So I'm on the fence on about whether or not this is a predisposed thing, the addiction thing, right? You know, like we're taught or we're told in the sober community that we have a disease and we were most likely born with it. And some people are able to navigate around it. And some people aren't. But I have been thinking a lot about it because I believe that human beings were put on this planet to love and be loved. I do believe that all the actions we take is in an effort to love or be loved. Everything we do, good and bad. You know, there's very few living beings that share this love thing with us, right? I think dolphins and one other mammal, maybe. And so it's a very, very powerful thing. We're driven to want to be wanted and to want others, right? It's like part of our DNA. It's part of our makeup. And I could be wrong because I do know a number of people that grew up in loving households that ended up, you know, on Skid Row. But I believe that one thing that's happening in our current society and culture and community is that there are so many stressors today, very different than what was even 100 years ago. So many stressors that have left people that have pulled families apart and pulled that love unit apart. And parents have been too stressed out to parent. And they've stopped telling their children and showing their children that they love them. I know for me personally, when I was a child, young, I had a very, very rough household. And my father was very, very aggressive and violent and abusive. And I don't blame him for my addiction. I don't. But I do know that it definitely played a part in it. I went to look for love in all the wrong places. I got sexually molested. I was a criminal at a very young age. I thought, you know, like the crew that I hung out with, also known as gang, was reaching my hand out to be loved, to feel a part of. And so I do believe we have a real love problem. I think that that love problem is highly due in part to the enormous amount of stress in this country to perform, to have money, to keep up with the Joneses, to.
This whole culture, again, it comes down to the culture. It's so focused on productivity, and we're not worth anything, you know, unless we're producing, and it's made us sick. And I would only add, and the reason I think this is frowned upon, what am I about to say, is because of those Calvinistic puritanical roots. But in addition to love, love is one thing that makes us feel good. We're not encouraged to do things that feel good. And we're certainly not encouraged to question the things that make us feel bad and why we're doing them. You know, all that stress, all that work, for what? To eat. Well, why do we eat? To live. Well, why do we live? No one can answer that. Apparently to die. Because we're not enjoying this incredible, amazing experience. Like you say, love. I mean, Alan Watts used to say, humans suffer because we take seriously what the gods intended for fun. There's no even purpose. We're obsessed with purpose. There is no purpose for the universe, let alone life on Earth. It's just, it comes out of an exuberance, out of a really a playfulness.
This podcast is brought to you by, you guessed it, Creatures of Habit. Creatures of Habit is a lifestyle and wellness brand. We launched the brand with a product called The Protagonist. It is a superhuman oatmeal. It is not just regular oatmeal. It is plant-based, dairy-free, non-GMO, gluten-free, packed with 30 grams of plant-based protein, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin D3, probiotic, digestive enzymes, truly the best thing you can put in your body to kickstart your day, used as a pre-workout meal or a post-workout meal. This is a meal, everybody. This is not a snack. This is a meal. It is perfect for on the go. Use promo code KOHPOD20, the number 20. That's KOHPOD20 at checkout when you pop over to creaturesofhabit.com. That is creatures with a K, creaturesofhabit.com. We appreciate you. We love you. And now on to the pod. Why do you think being an expert in the recovery space, now also doing his doctorate in clinical psychology, you obviously have spent a fair amount of time dissecting the psyche, I would imagine specifically around addiction. What, in your opinion, distinguishes the addict from the person that can have a few drinks and party once a year?
Once the habit develops, the limbic brain ends up cutting out the middleman, cutting out the prefrontal cortex, our executive functions of deciding and choosing and planning and all of these things. And it just links up directly with sort of our motor control. So drinking and drug use it is progressive. It goes from compulsion. I'm compelled to drink because it's self-soothing. I'm soothing the stress. And I mean, there's all the studies with the adverse childhood experiences. So someone who's had even four, or if it's a male who's had six adverse childhood experiences, his chance of becoming an IV drug user, for example, increased by like 4,000%. I mean, so there, right there, we have it. But that compulsion to drink, to self-soothe, turns into pure impulse. There is no thought process. There is no thinking.
So it is scientific. Scientifically now, you would argue that it's proven that it is a progressive disease. And I personally, potentially based on my trauma as a child, I am way more prone to abusing drugs and alcohol because of the self-soothing, self-medicating escape opportunity that it offers. I am way more prone to it than someone with zero childhood trauma.
Well, exactly. And so we have progressed in our thinking from this being a moral failure, like it may have been during that era of the birth of the asylum, that, you know, I'm a sinner, you know, that's how I found myself here. I'm like morally corrupt, to being a disease, and the disease model was an improvement. And we've gone from kind of a genetic deterministic model, which is now, it's been debunked. Even the people, it was on the front page of like Time magazine in the 90s, like, you know, researchers isolate the addiction gene. They came along later and said, no, you've completely misunderstood our research. There is no gene for addiction. There's certain risk factors, like a gene for sensitivity and a gene for like,
So this idea that there's a gene that diabetics have, that the correlation there is just total
no BS. And I mean, everything's epigenetic anyway, and so even if you had some of these genes, they still have to be expressed. They have to be through like a methylation process. They have to be switched on and off, and that's all environment. So we've gone from moral failure to sort of a genetic determinism or neurological determinism, but now even that is moving to, in terms of the neurology, we're moving to neuroplasticity, where, you know, the brain we're born with, or that we have right now through development of new habits, is totally changeable through learning and everything. And then the same with genes, they're switched on and on. It's actually more like a dimmer, you know, and they can be switched on and they can be switched back off. Now, for me, what I think the newest frontier is, because we end up in another determinism now. We found ourselves in an effort to get out of genetic determinism and sort of neurological determinism, we've ended up in an environmental determinism, where our environment will determine how, you know, whether we're addicted or have mental health problems or even physical ailments, medical problems later in life. And here's where I think the most interesting thing is, and this is the newest frontier that I think will emerge, is humans, unlike most other creatures, have an ability to create their environment. We have more of an impact. They even call this the Anthropocene, because it's a whole geological age that is characterized by human impacts. If you look around, everything around you always was built by human hands in a creative enterprise, and it could be built differently. And again, in our sort of like cultural habits, our customs, we have a hard time imagining, like the addict can't imagine a better world, better life for themselves. Well, we can't imagine collectively a better world, because it doesn't have to be like this. So the cases of child abuse, neglect, and the sort of empathic failures that result in mental health and addiction problems could be otherwise if we like looked at the benefits of something beyond the nuclear family, where whole communities could be involved in raising kids, where, you know, both parents, even since the 1950s and 60s now, have to work, where maybe both parents wouldn't have to work, and there wasn't such this grinding stress. So even the harshness that our parents can treat us with, and the ruthless competition that is sort of the hallmark feature of our American culture, which is, I think, taking this huge toll on us, It doesn't have to be like that. But the culture is transmitted through individual parents to their kids. Like, we're in so much fear about, I don't know, just our own security or survival or whatever anxieties we have. And we put those all in our kids and we indoctrinate our kids and we send them off to these like industrial training schools, you know, that the Rockefeller set up and everything. I cry when I like drop my kids off at school. I'm like, what am I doing? But we're all involved. We're involved in this, these like horrible, awful habits that include like child slavery and ecological collapse. Like, we're all involved. And we need to be shaken out of this. We need to break these habits because they're going to destroy us and the whole planet, frankly.
We all know that we can break a bad habit. You're a living, breathing example of someone who did not believe that there was an opportunity, a solution to break this terrible habit that you used as salvation for the first probably 10 years that you did it. And then it became most, I would imagine, similar to me, like the bane of your existence, and you couldn't stop doing it, but you hated every minute of it towards the end, for me anyway.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
You said that you'll be celebrating 17 years in recovery. Mm-hmm. And I just celebrated 18 years. Here's the question. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that someone in recovery has the ability to go back to casually drinking or no?
In 2005, we had just opened our center and I took a couple of our clients, first clients, to the IKIPA, which is the International Young People in AA conference up in San Francisco. It was so much fun. It was like 3 days. And the last day, I'm looking at the calendar, the schedule, and Dr. Gabor Mate, I've never heard of him, was speaking in one of the conference rooms. And I hung on every word he said. And he's still, you know, one of my favorite people who I owe a lot to this thinking outside the box, I guess, on addiction to. After there was a Q&A, one of the questions was that exact question. He says, yeah, I do. I think so. I mean, the air got sucked out of this room. I mean, people gasped. And he says, no, I wouldn't recommend it. I've played with that idea philosophically. And, you know, I think he would probably agree that maybe in some ways our traumas never resolve, unfortunately. I certainly know in my life, the stressors I have in my life, I would love to come home and have a drink on a lot of days. I really would. But I don't, because I know it's not really going to improve anything. Theoretically, I think it's possible based on evidence that I think people have done it. I don't think things are as cut and dry and black and white as a lot of, frankly, people in recovery make it out to be. And you're going to be able to develop new habits and be more mindful. And I think in a sense, you know, as far as we can control anything, control drinking and drug use, assuming we're somewhat at peace with the world and with ourselves. Again, I don't know how realistic that is, that the more I learn about psychology and trauma, I sort of think it's a feature that the suffering in this life, at least this life right now, is the way it is. I also happen to believe it's something we should work on reducing and eliminating, both in our own lives, but in the lives of others. I also think it's going to take hundreds of years. Doesn't mean we shouldn't get started and do whatever we can do. And in all of, you know, whether we're cooking food for people, making the world a more beautiful place, being kind to each other, there's all these things we can do. I believe in the power of the imagination. Again, even imagining that the world could be better. So many people have lost hope. So cultivating a sense of hope in the future. So yeah, it's not something I'm going to try. And, you know, I think I owe it to the people we treat to not be a hypocrite. And so I don't drink, don't smoke weed. I don't take pills because I want to show people it's possible that for a lot of people, abstinence, at least for some period of time, is important. Learning to cope with life and enjoy life without those things is important.
For the audience listening and someone here who potentially is struggling or on the fence or trying to figure out whether they are or they're not, whether it's impacting their life in a way that they should be considering taking a break or throwing in the mm-hmm. towel, what kind of advice could you give to that person who is struggling?
Be mindful, be aware. We have this like gift of consciousness, of self-reflection and awareness to use in all areas of our lives. And so to be aware of our habits, like things we were blind to and took for granted, like how do we get to work? Why do we always go that way? You know, couldn't obviously maybe it's the quickest way, but shake things up, go a different way, change up your morning routine a little bit. When you go for a walk, your morning walk, like do you find yourself walking around the same circuit? Because I think addiction is like, obviously these are neural pathways that have been deeply etched. And they talk a lot about this in the sort of literature around psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, that the main kind of mechanism of action and why those drugs are working so well, you know, 400% better than traditional antidepressants, for example, according to one Johns Hopkins study, is because it almost like smooths out those deep ruts so that we can kind of form new ones. But we kind of have to know where the ruts are first initially to even consider taking a different path, taking a different road. You know, if we're afraid of people, like jump into situations, social situations, strike up conversations with people in the elevator or whatever it might be, like do things differently.
But if someone's literally listening to this podcast and deep into their addiction and deep into their thing, but they really are trying to figure out a way to stop, is there any advice that you would give that person that they can apply?
Like you would probably say, I mean, you have to replace one habit for another. And it's going to be, and as you know very well, it's kind of a day at a time thing. And those days are precious. So the person who can not drink for one day, that's one day. And then the same person who then hasn't had to drink in 2 days, that's 2 days. And the more days we can string together this new habit, like a habit that can be not doing something. I have a habit of not drinking for 17 years. So we can develop that alone. And by the time they've got 10 days, 30 days, that becomes very precious. And the chances of them losing that become, I think, less likely because they're going to want to hold on to that and build on that. Things like walking. I mean, endorphins. People don't understand, I think, how powerful endorphins are, where they too work better than traditional antidepressants, according to at least a couple of studies. Endorphin, of course, is short for endogenous morphine-like compounds that our own body produces. We have opioid receptors in our brain, but you know, people have these receptors in their brain who are descended from people who live nowhere near an opioid or an opiate plant. So why do we have these receptors? Well, it's for the endogenous morphine-like compounds that we ourselves produce in our bodies to make us feel good. Being with people, having dinner with friends, that makes us feel good. Love makes us feel good. I mean, we need habits. We need hobbies. We need habits that are fun, habits that bring us joy.
You know, I'm listening to you and it's just, and I'm just thinking, you know, there are people that don't do anything, right? There are people, and I know them. There are some that I love, you know, that I've been trying to help, but literally don't do anything. And specifically with the pandemic and the lockdown, right? Yeah. Like it really took the person who is truly introverted, truly an isolator, and just made that okay. Like made it truly, you know, acceptable to not leave your house, not leave your apartment, stay inside. And that, you know, when you say, oh, that person doesn't do anything, that person is, you know, the truth is that in itself is a habit. Not doing anything is as bad or as much of a habit as doing something. And so I do believe that all of our decisions made consistently are habits that will determine happiness or misery in our lives and life or death. And you are at the forefront of it. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time with me today, but it is so important that people understand this idea that, you know, addicts are not bad people. Like you said, they have taken a knife and just carved into this one spot over and over and over and over again. And it's just gotten deeper and deeper and deeper and very, very difficult. If you've got a paper route and that's the way you make your money and you know that you need that money to survive and you know that route is this way, take a two lefts, take a right, take a left, take a right. And you know that that's going to get you the money. And you've been doing that for years. Very, very hard to break out of that paper route.
Yeah, how we get out of that, it's honestly, I struggle with it. We've been doing this for 12 years. You know, I've been in the recovery world for a long time. Like, what is that moment? What is that little sliver of light that gets in through the cracks? It's nothing short of a miracle that helps us break out of those habits.
And it can happen.
It can happen. It happens all the time.
I do want to finish on this because I think it's so important to say that change is absolutely 1,000 million billion percent possible. The only problem is no one's going to do it for you. And that is the hardest part about being a family member of an addict, a friend of an addict, a father of an addict, a son of an addict, a husband or wife of an addict. You could sit there and beg on your hands and knees and cry hysterically and beg for someone who's struggling with addiction to change. And unless that person actually wants to or and is ready to make the change, your begging and your crying and your moaning and your groaning is only making it worse for that person. And I know that's so hard to say. It's so hard to say. And I'm a culprit of it because I have my best friend, my lifelong best friend is as deep as anyone can be. Deeper than deep. Went from Skid Row, somehow, some way got out of Skid Row and is now living back in New York, upstate and out of his car. And this man is like my brother. Like 5 years ago, he was married, about to have kids, you know, like had 10 years sober. I mean, just amazing. And to see how this could possibly happen. And I begged him, I've flown out to LA, threw him in my pickup truck, drove him to the desert, got him a shaman to come meet us. I was like, maybe if I try to do some of this, you know, psychedelic stuff, maybe he can, you know, smooth out those surfaces. But he was interested in doing the experience. He had no interest in changing. It's such a devastating thing because it becomes a habit that people think they escape reality with. It's just a fallacy. It's not true. You don't escape reality. You never do. It's just you are where you are, and the things that you walk around with stay with you until you turn around and start dealing with them in reality, you know. So,
and using them to help other people with. And that's the most beautiful thing in our, all of that pain. It turns out we can make some meaning out of and at the very least comfort others with by saying, hey, you know, I get it. Me too.
Bottom line, we are all capable of change, no matter how far gone you are, no matter how bad it is, no matter how sick you are, no matter how addicted you are, no matter how much money you have to hustle to use and drink and whatever it is, I promise with every cell in my body that you can change too.
This podcast is brought to you by, you guessed it, Creatures of Habit. Creatures of Habit is a lifestyle and wellness brand rooted in functional nutrition. The protagonist is a superhuman, incredibly delicious instant and overnight oatmeal blend developed to feed your body the most optimized blend of vitamins, minerals, and macros. With premium oats, 30 grams of plant-based protein, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin D3, a probiotic, and digestive enzymes in each pouch, you will never have to think about what to eat for breakfast, pre-workout or post-workout meal, or a healthy meal any time of the day in a pinch. Made 4 simple and convenient ways. 1, just add hot water. 2, overnight in the fridge. 3, add to a delicious smoothie or simply put in the microwave. Take the stress out of worrying about what to eat for a healthy and delicious way to kickstart your day. And if you fast, this is the perfect meal one as it delivers wellness, satiety, and delicious flavors. Pop over to creaturesofhabit.com. That's creaturesofhabit.com with a K, creaturesofhabit.com, and put in promo code KOHPOD20 for 20% off your first order.
So Evan, man, I can't thank you enough for taking the time with me. This was really a cathartic experience for me. And so I really appreciate you. And when I come out to California, are you out in Cali?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm gonna give you a high five. I will be out there in October for an event, so I'm gonna shoot you a buzz, and I'd love to meet you in person.
Me too, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Thanks for joining the podcast. Where can we find you and get your book?
You can find the book on Amazon. Can America Recover? Reimagining the Drug Problem. And you can visit Oro House Recovery Centers at ororecovery.com and read about us and our, we think, different approach there.
I appreciate you.
Thanks,
have
Michael.
Have a great rest of your week, and look forward to sharing this amazing content with the community.
Thank you so much.
And there you have it, folks. I hope we delivered some valuable content for you to implement into your life on a daily basis. Please remember that our habits have the power to make us or break us. Replacing bad habits with great ones is the answer to living a life of happiness, optimism, and high performance. We are capable of achieving anything. We all have what it takes to give it all we've got. Commit to one great habit each day and truly commit, and watch how everything in your life starts evolving from good to great. If you enjoyed this podcast, please follow us wherever you listen to your podcast. Give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. That will help us grow this podcast, bring on more amazing guests, and continue to deliver invaluable content on a weekly basis. Lastly, please share this podcast with any friends or family that you think might appreciate it. And always remember, want plus do equals have. Until the next one, fam. Peace.